Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This episode is brought to you by our Patreon supporters. Become a patron today at patreon.com/intotheportal. The year was unknown. The dirty cobblestone streets of Westminster lay far below the third-story window where a young maid was preparing herself for the night ahead. It was a new household, and one that brought her to the highly coveted Berkeley Square, a place where the rich and influential rubbed shoulders and where the houses exuded luxury. That is, except for number 50, the house where she found herself employed. The outer face of the building had a filthy, cobwebbed appearance, littered with garbage and handbills, things that did not seem to match up with the rest of the neighborhood surrounding it. Odd, she thought. Not thinking on it for too long, the young maid went about her work, eventually settling down for the evening. It was well after midnight when a horrible, insane shrieking began, waking up the entire house in a blind panic. The lord of the house rushed upstairs to the third floor, his heavy footsteps pounding on the stairs as he went, two at a time in his haste to get to the distressed woman. Finally reaching the top of the stairs, ripping open the heavy bedroom door, the maid was found petrified. Standing rigid in the far corner of the room, her skin had turned sheet white, and her bulging eyes betrayed the sheer amount of terror pouring through her veins. The only words she managed to utter was, "Please, don't let it touch me." Never regaining her senses, the poor woman was committed to an asylum until her passing a mere week after the incident, while the nameless thing of number 50 Berkeley would continue to terrorize residents and trespassers alike over a span of nearly 200 years. Join us on Into the Portal for one of London's most terrifying mysteries, the horror of Berkeley Square.
Hello, and welcome back into the portal. I'm Amber Ray.
And I'm Andrew McKay. Welcome back, everyone.
Mm-hmm, welcome.
It feels like it hasn't been that long because we released a Friday episode this week.
We did.
Which was sweet.
And we're really stoked on it. We got some great feedback so far.
Really positive.
Film Friday. I think it's going to be big.
I think it's going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
Super, super fun. Yeah. So again, yeah, shoot us your ideas for Film Friday.
Yeah, we've already got a few in the bank and we're going to keep adding to it.
Oh, yeah. So before we get started, we just have a, as usual, tiny bit of housekeeping, and I wanted to kick that off with a shout out to one of our listeners named Matt Drew. So thank you so much, man, because he always reaches out to us.
He's always engaged.
He's always super engaged. Big supporter of the show, and we really appreciate it. So just wanted to give you a shout out, man.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we also have some new reviews.
We do.
Which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
We always love them. Keep them rolling in, you guys.
Please.
So we had a few new ones on the US iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one was a laugh. Kind of.
Oh, for sure. Oh, I had a blast. And honestly, I would recommend anyone who's on the US iTunes, just click on Trashery and see the myriad of hilarious reviews this guy has left. People that are incredibly negative and just weird. But
so he gave us a soaring one-star review titled, "Ugh." and then basically proceeded to say that we talk over each other too much banter, blah, blah, blah.
La, la, la.
Anyways,
Yeah. But I thought it was funny because thank you. I just want to say.
Oh, yeah. This, yeah.
Because you listened to 10 of our episodes. So yeah. I appreciate that. We appreciate the determination to like
seriously.
Us.
Seriously. Right? He's like, I gave up after 10 episodes. It's like, dude, that's like 18 hours of ITP content.
It
bro.
Is.
So
anyway, pretty funny.
Yeah. Also, big thank you to D is for Darkness for their sweet 5-star review. Says to give her a listen. So listen to the man.
Give
her
a listen.
Yeah. So listen to this guy. Check us out. If you're already listening to us, then you're already listening. So it doesn't really. Yeah. But thank you again for that 5-star review from D is for Darkness. Really appreciate it.
That was funny because yeah. I wrote that in. It was like, yeah, like he says to give her a listen. So give us a listen. But wait, you're already listening. Wah, wah.
Yeah.
We also had one from John Granner. And thank you. That was very cogent remarks on the depth of research, originality of topics. We always appreciate that. So thank you for your recommendation.
Definitely.
We had one from Australia, Heavy Brettles.
Heavy Brettles.
Woohoo. Yeah. 5 stars. And he says he found us through Monsters Among Us, and now he's hooked.
Sweet.
So that's awesome.
That's a good feeling to be included in a company like that.
Yeah, that was really cool.
Such an amazing job with that show. So
this next one is great. I love it. It's from Budrick the Zombie, and it's actually on Stitcher Radio. So we cool. don't often check our other platforms, but we're starting to now be more regular. So if you do use those, like Podbean, all that kind of stuff, just make sure you, if you want to give us a review, we would love to see it.
Totally.
So anyways, this guy, it was from 12 days ago. He says, precious material this side of the portal. Do yourself a favor and just subscribe. Amber Ray and Andrew McKay or Drooper McRae.
Oh my God.
Drooper McRae.
My alter ego that people don't really know about.
We're going to start using that. That's hilarious.
All right.
But anyways, he says we're not only the most down-to-earth and friendly hosts of podcasting, but they're also front runners in reporting lesser-known spooky events and unsolved mysteries that the bigger shows either do not know about or don't bother to cover.
Wow.
ITB is a wonderful cast for those who are tired of hearing about Bigfoot, shadow people, which are old news, and are looking for something they haven't seen before. Easily binge-worthy. Wish you could give him more than 5 stars, he says, which, thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
Really appreciate
much.
That. It's so awesome.
It means a ton.
It really does. And so again, like I said, we did get some love on Podbean, which was actually a few months old.
Yeah,
so
sorry
we apologize.
About that, guys.
We're kind of not on top of that. But thank you for your love. Hilarious. We had one from Wes.
Yeah.
Oh, that was so funny. Love the bun rating system there. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
And flavors, oh my gosh, they have a profile picture with a pug wearing a bow tie, which I'm just a sucker for pugs. So.
Sure.
Anyways, easy. We love your style and the raving review, so thank you very much.
So just thanks to everyone. That's just... It
so much love.
It truly makes our day. It helps the show so, so much to kind of give us more exposure. So keep rolling them in. We really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Once more, just want to reiterate too that we have our ITP pumpkin carving contest before we get started here. So we're coming down to the wire, not really, but we're getting close to Halloween.
It's the 21st.
And we've already had one really awesome submission, and there's a few trickling in as well, but the standout so far has been the chewy Chewbacca pumpkin from
thanks, Chris.
From Chris
sweet.
Over at More Gooder Than Podcast. So make sure to go check those guys out as well. But we're running that contest. So we're gonna have a sweet prize pack put together. We have the boys from Kryptonaut Podcast that are helping us judge. So all you got to do is follow us on whatever social media platform you choose to post your jack-o'-lantern, tag us in your post, follow the Kryptonaut boys as well, and and then we're just going to be going through all the submissions and seeing how artistic you guys are. So let's get those creepy
jack-o'-lanterns. How creative can you get?
Indeed.
And it doesn't have to be good. Like, it can be like, because I know
I am
not
good. You are the more artistically inclined person in this.
But even like a pumpkin, it's hard, man. So whatever.
Totally.
If it doesn't come out looking the way you thought it was going to look, just post it anyway.
It's all
fine.
Good. Yeah. We just want to have fun with it. So.
Yeah.
All right. Are we ready to dive into tonight's topic?
We are.
All right.
So tonight we are heading back to Britain to discuss one of the most haunted places in the history of London and continues to this day, some would say. It's a home with unexplainable activity. Residing in the desirable neighborhood of Mayfair in the West End of London, the city of New Westminster, which is a major tourist site today, right. And was bustling way back in the 1800s and 1900s as well.
Right.
So the focus here is on 50 Berkeley Square.
Yes.
It was a nice but otherwise ordinary 4-story brick house.
Yeah.
Just like any other in the neighborhood, and you can do a Google search and quickly discover that. It's very nice looking now.
Yeah.
Apparently back in the day was not the case. It was a little bit more dilapidated, in a state of disrepair, some would say, right. and for very poignant reasons. Mm. So, as the years wore on in London, and this is in the 1800s we're talking about, because right. This particular neighborhood came about in the late 1700s,
yeah.
and the entire square was built by... Oh, who was,
William
who was
Kent
that guy?
Was
William
the, Kent was sort of the famous architect or whatever. And,
Kent, eh?
Yeah.
That in itself, like, doesn't he have a town?
I wonder
or
if there
area
are
named after
ties
him?
To the area,
area of Kent.
Kent. Who knows? I
yeah.
don't know.
But anyways, the whole neighborhood is one of those ones that's more upscale.
Hmm.
Lots of lords, ladies, dukes, and other esteemed and wealthy members of London's upper class have been known to make residence. I believe you mentioned it, Andrew. Winston Churchill actually resided in 50 Berkeley Square at one point in his life.
I don't
life.
Think it was actually 50, but it was on
oh,
the square.
Sorry,
so
just
it was,
in
he was
the
a
square.
Neighbor of 50 Berkeley Square.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But it's interesting because even after its construction, in its early days, it definitely had a marked history.
Mm-hmm.
And William Kent, yeah, like we said, he was the designer, opened its doors to tenants at the end of the 18th century, as we said.
Right.
It was kind of a rental-style building before it had any permanent residence in the 1800s.
Yeah, like a really fancy boarding house,
basically. Yeah, exactly. So there's lots of different occupants, lots of people occupying rooms, and then there were whispers of strange residents that were occupying 50 Berkeley.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was these early years that it was sort of, it got this its first brushes with, I mean, tragedy, so to speak, I guess,
mm-hmm.
or something horrifying. When witnesses actually were standing in the street one evening, I guess walking by, it was sort of, it must have been in the summer or spring when people were out and about.
Mm-hmm.
And people witnessed a young girl who was allegedly named Adeline plunge to her death from the top story windows, from the attic window. So this is actually above the fourth story, just above the fourth story. It is said that she was attempting to escape the advances of her abusive uncle. And then after her tragic death, the residents in the square reported having a haunting vision of this ghost fallen from this upper story window, like, repeatedly over and over again, the same suicide.
Almost like nightly, hey? Just like an echo of
yeah.
what happened.
So right off the bat here, people are sort of thinking that they're dealing with a haunting, a haunted house.
It definitely had the reputation of a haunted house.
Definitely. Because of these, yeah, these brushes with just, yeah, very negative things, basically.
That's interesting. Like, okay, so that is one of the Genesis stories, right? Because it's referenced in a lot of travel documentaries, a lot of, like, haunted UK videos and different publications and things. There were a couple different instances. And like I alluded to, there were talk of strange residents. One person in particular, Mr. Dupree,
right.
we'll get into, because he was definitely a shady character, to say
yeah,
the least. But it's interesting, though, because, okay, right off the bat, like, it's a new building, a new fresh start.
So it shouldn't have a very marked past. Yet,
well, exactly,
anyway, right?
exactly. Like, it comes about very early on.
Definitely.
Which is interesting, because initially when we were doing the research, we came across some of the later stories, and we didn't know where it all originated from. And
right.
I was like, where's the nut of this story?
Exactly.
And then this
where's
is where
the
we
one
kinda...
massive, you know, massacre or something, or
well,
one
exactly.
whatever, right?
Yeah, totally.
I have a quote here from Charles Harper, who's the author of Haunted Houses, that was published in 1913.
Cool.
And there's been many authors that have either gone into the 50 Berkeley to do their writing or written about 50 Berkeley
Square.
Very
inspiring for horror literature.
Totally. So anyway, it goes as follows. And there's, it sounds a little strange because it's, I don't even know the what's it called? Not dialect, but the colloquialisms, or
oh,
so
yeah.
to speak, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The haunted house in Berkeley Square was long. One of those things that no country cousin came up from the provinces to London on a sightseeing bent, ever willingly missed. Number 50 wore an exceedingly uncared for appearance. Soap, paint, and whitewash were unused for years, and grime clung to the brickwork and windows alike. The area was choked with wasted handbills, wisps of straw, and all the accumulations of the speedily made a derelict London house.
It's so funny. This is a very...
it's weird sort of phrasing, eh?
It is weird phrasing.
The very picture...
Like handbills. Okay,
oh,
wait,
yeah.
A handbill is actually a flyer.
Right.
I
forgot
that.
What it was. I was like, wait a second. Do you have like a duck bill? What are you doing?
A hand bill. Yeah. At first I thought it was actually like money. I thought it was, you know, like bills that you'd carry around. But no, it's actually like a flyer.
Well, obviously it's not just like cash laying around.
Well, that's what I know. I was like, whoa, is this a really rich neighborhood? Right. Like, geez, people are just throwing away money.
So he goes on to say, this house was the very picture of misery. And every passing stranger stopped the first errand boy and asked various questions to them. To which the answer was generally haunted house.
Haunted house.
Very loamy accent.
Very loamy.
Or if the question happened to be who lives there, the obvious reply was ghostesses.
Ghostesses. I don't even know. I can't do it in
the British. So the point of that is that the public consciousness was that this was the most haunted place in the city. Mm-hmm. And it was a place to be wary of.
Exactly. Obviously, this publication comes well after the construction.
Totally.
A century or more after.
Yeah, like, yeah, over.
So
well
it's
over
had time to accumulate, because in this century, in the 1800s, we're going to have a lot of colorful stories and different haunting tales. But going back to its genesis, I did mention that Mr. Dupre.
Yeah.
And he is not very well known as far as, like, historical record, but definitely in British folklore, he is very much known.
Yeah.
And this was because he supposedly had an insane brother who lived with him at Berkeley Square, 50 right. Berkeley Square. And this brother was the type that you don't really show to the public, apparently, because he was kept locked away in the third story room. This room in particular in the third story is going to be the focal point of all of these paranormal encounters, tragedies, different
for
deaths.
For the most part, yeah.
Things like that. So, definitely the hot zone.
Yeah.
But this guy, Mr. Dupre, he and his brother lived there for a time. I'm not sure how many years. And I'm not sure what the fate of them were in the end.
Yeah.
But supposedly, this insane brother, which I'm not even sure, he's just literally described as insane or just like
so it's like at the time this heart
almost
was
like
back.
Hyde, like a Jekyll and Hyde is kind of what I'm imagining.
Exactly, that's exactly.
And
what
obviously, saying. Like we just covered with one of our last episodes, the Airedale Asylum, these types of mental illnesses and things that people didn't understand were not
it
kosher.
It could have been schizophrenia. It could have been anything.
Could have been anything. So, anyways, he kept him locked away, gave him his meals through a hole in the door, didn't even really give him any chance to be sociable or anything like that. But the rumor goes that one day he locked a little girl in with his insane brother, and no one knows what her fate was, but many attest to seeing a ghostly little girl wandering the halls and wandering around the street outside 50 Berkeley. So again, this was one of the early stories, one of the nut stories that kind of contributed to this sort of
genesis of the folklore.
Well, just the reputation in general of the house.
Yeah, for sure.
So, then we get into a little bit more mainstream, I guess, a little bit more
I mean, it is.
Like, confirmed history, because then we get an actual prime minister that lived at Berkeley Square,
that's
which
right.
is very interesting. It wasn't until 1827 that it became the home of George Canning, which is actually still commemorated by a plaque that you can see on the front of the house. It's a blue plaque, circular, and if you Google Earth it, you can see it from the street view. Mm-hmm. But Canning, he wasn't the first long-term resident. He obviously took over the whole house, I'm imagining. He didn't have roommates.
No.
And so that's when it kind of transitioned into a single household. Yeah, so apparently, I'm not sure how long George Canning actually occupied the house, because supposedly he lived there until 1827. So
right,
he could have been there.
Death. Yeah.
Exactly. And Canning is a very interesting guy. He was a Tory. And he had a long, colorful career in British politics, mostly serving under King George IV, who actually disliked Canning and tried to thwart his foreign policies to no avail, apparently. Mm-hmm. And he did serve as a senior cabinet minister under several PMs until he was chosen to succeed Lord Liverpool. He had to resign because he had some major health problems.
Oh, I see.
But interestingly, Canning only reigned as PM for less than 4 months or 119 days before he actually died himself. And this makes him the shortest serving prime minister in all of England, apparently.
Yeah, 4 months ain't a long time.
Not to say that his death had anything to do with Berkeley Square, because he actually wasn't in the residence at the time of his death.
Right.
But apparently he was the first person, according to some sources, to experience activity within the house. So as a resident, I'm assuming, because obviously people in the streets were making their own observations and comments and all this kind of stuff.
This was the first rumors
are starting to spread.
Exactly. This was the first poignant kind of like take on the house from somebody that is a historical figure.
Exactly. Yes. So Canning, he definitely had some experiences. He did hear inexplicable sounds emanating from various places around the home, with the basement singled out in particular.
Yeah.
He also had horrific nightmares that were repeated. So that's weird. Again, that kind of reminds me of like echoes of something. There's some sort of energy that's there that's manifesting and it's trying to fight through and trying to get people to notice it almost.
Exactly.
So he did pass away, but again, it was at a different location. Despite it being his home, he was actually visiting family, the story goes, which I'm not sure, we'd have to dig a little bit further just to confirm all that.
Yeah.
But it was just an interesting point of note. He's actually buried at Westminster Abbey. So again, like, it's interesting, right? Because you get a lot of sort of craziness at the very genesis. And then early into the 1800s, you get this very notable figure living there.
Right.
Which does speak, again, to the type of neighborhood it was, right? Yeah,
super, super, super duper fancy.
And super duper.
The interesting thing about this, I find that he never described what kind of nightmares he was having. I mean, obviously, a nightmare is a nightmare, but is it the exact same nightmare reoccurring, or is it just you're having, nightmares
Or was he envisioning things in his dreams that other people later on would go to envision and be literally petrified by?
Right.
To the point where they lost their minds and either were found dead or died shortly after.
Yeah. But I mean, repeated nightmares is a good indication that there's a presence.
Yeah.
For sure. So things would slowly get worse at number 50 Berkeley Square, essentially, for anyone who kind of taunted the house, so to speak, who thought that they could handle it. They would hear the stories and didn't really think much
exactly.
of them.
It's funny, though, because after Canning, it kind of... We couldn't really find who lived there.
While.
I don't know if there was just like a caretaker living there with, obviously someone owned it, but we couldn't really uncover that.
Well, okay, here's the thing. Back in the day, the way real estate worked in the UK was like way different than now. So like it would make sense that there would be like a permanent caretaker for the residents, even if the home wasn't technically...
Occupied?
Occupied or... owned by one individual person, so to speak.
Oh, okay. So it could have been state-owned.
There was different systems for, like, titles for land back in the day. And I just... It doesn't necessarily mean if there's a caretaker there that there has to be, like, an owner of the house, I don't think.
Or maybe it was just kind of in Canning's family, and they just hadn't figured out what to do with it, or...
Could have been something like that, yeah. Or just owned by the... Yeah, I mean, like, I guess all these people living in this area are descendants of royalty, essentially, right? So it's just maybe gone back into the trusts of whoever owns the actual land it's on, basically, right?
That's true. And just the idea of there being a nameless owner, a nameless landlord, kind of comes into play for a lot of the history of this house.
Yeah.
There was one name I came across, Bierstead, but I'm not sure how long he actually had held onto the house for. But anyways.
Yeah. So, anyway... In 1840, we kind of got the next development in this story.
So definitely by this point, it has a very firm reputation as the haunted house of London.
Pretty much. And yeah, so in 1840, there was a 20-year-old nobleman named Sir Robert Warboys. So he was the son of royalty, essentially, of nobility. And
Warboy, that's a funny name.
It's kind of a funny name. So the story basically goes that he was out drinking with friends in a nearby area, and they were discussing tales of the town, ghost stories, different folklore and things like that. And one of the ones that came up was, of course, the haunting of number 50 Berkeley Square. So super already in the public consciousness. And this was obviously the tip top of what was scary, because he ends up taking a bet. So basically, he heard the alleged haunted house, and he laughed at the idea of it being haunted. He laughed at the idea of ghosts, of monsters, different things like this.
Uh-oh.
But his friends felt otherwise, and so they dared him to spend a night alone in the house, in the room that was claimed to be haunted.
This is classic, like, rich boy mentality. Totally. Like, nothing can touch me, and all this kind of stuff. This is fun.
Very much so.
Oh. Perfect lead up for like a horror movie.
So I'm assuming this was the room on the third floor, because there's instances in the attic as well, which on the fourth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But all over the house there's been experiences, right? So anyway, Sir Robert accepted their challenge. Now, this is again where you, like you just mentioned, things are vague. So like the nameless landlord at the time of number 50 was apparently horrified at the idea and really didn't want to let them do it, but finally agreed upon the proposal because they were very, very persistent. And this Sir Robert Warboys was a well-known person in the area.
Wonder if they greased him up a little bit with some cash.
I wonder. Actually, they probably did.
Probably.
So basically the two conditions that the landlord stated to Warboys was the first that he had to take with him a loaded pistol into the room. And the second was that he would use the servant's bell to summon assistance if he required it, if he was under attack, essentially, right?
Freaky little bells, man.
Yeah.
So bells in horror movies.
I know. Right? Well, especially back in the day, that's your only doorbell. That's all you got. It's just a horrifying sound. Of a bell. So Robert, not afraid, goes upstairs. Everything's seemingly normal. I don't know. Like, he's going up there to prove his friends wrong, and he's feeling confident, right?
Mm-hmm.
The story goes that shortly after midnight, so he's up there for a few hours. Everything's fine. Quiet. He's up there around 10 o'clock. Then shortly after midnight, the servant's bell starts to gently ring. Just a gentle ringing. And then after a short pause, the bell begins to furiously ring. Very, very loudly. Like, something transitioned very quickly in that scenario. So the landlord and the friends of Warboys dash up to the room, swing open the door to see Sir Robert, cowering in the corner. He's completely ghostly white, no blood in his face at all. He's petrified, and he's gripping the pistol, shaking his hand, pointing it out towards... Oh, I guess I should say at this point, they rush up and they hear a shot fired before they enter the room.
Oh,
one single shot.
Okay.
They bust open the door. He's cowering in the corner, pointing at what is no longer there. Nothing in the room. His eyes are bulging out of its sockets, and basically one version states that he was totally unable to speak and then died shortly after from the shock. In other accounts, they bust into the room, and he was already dead with his petrified hands, like, hardened over the grip of the pistol.
Yeah, his face contorted with fear is what I read, too. Almost, like, very similar to how in I'm sorry, I'm making a Harry Potter reference. In Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, when they find, because, like, the basilisk, and as soon as you look at it, it petrifies you.
Right.
Just the, yeah, like, that's kind of what that reminds
that
me
was
of.
Like, from the movie The Ring, too, wasn't it, right? They find the bodies, and they're all, like, weirdly contorted, like, the faces stretched out and, like, all weird and stuff.
As if they'd just seen the most terrifying thing in their lives before they died.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So basically the landlord, you know, he traced Robert's gaze to try to see, like, what were you aiming at? They find the bullet hole in the wall opposite to where he was sitting, and just speculated that he must have been firing at the famous ghost or thing of number 50 Berkeley Square. But of course the bullet had no effect.
Seemingly. And that becomes a commonality in a lot of these stories where weapons are brought into this room with people. It's not like they're venturing without anything that would possibly protect them. Maybe against a ghost, though, you're not going to, like, a gun.
It's the most frustrating thing. It's like every time Amber and I watch horror movies and I'm starting to get freaked out, I'm always like, these people are, like, walking into the woods. All they got is a hiking stick.
Yep.
Like, where's your 50 cal? And then I'm like, oh, wait. And then I get a sad face. I'm like, it wouldn't do anything.
Yeah.
Womp, 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 womp.
Well, maybe in some cases, like when we watched The Ritual, it seemed to have some effect on that creature, hey, when he finally, like...
Save it.
But anyways.
But yeah, no, that is a common thing, the single shot in this house. So what the hell is in this house?
I don't really
know. So far, we've got...
It gets weirder. Like, it seems like this house attracts colorful people that... are either have a few screws loose or are just, like you said, overly confident and to the point where they're almost taunting. the energies of this house.
Yeah, you can't hurt me, but wait a second.
But it's interesting, though, because you do get other people who occupy the house seemingly without any consequence. One of these people would be Miss Elizabeth Curzon, who did take over the house sometime after Canning. We're not exactly sure the date of that. But apparently she died in 1859 in the house of a peaceful, natural cause.
Yeah, so she was like 90 years old or something like that.
She was, yeah. And it's not as if they found her ghost white with like a contorted facial expression or anything.
Exactly.
Hopefully not. It wasn't mentioned in the literature.
None of the accounts I could find, that's for sure.
No. And it will come up again in more modern times where there was a Mr. Madges who comes and occupies the house. And he, again, has a very peaceful experience where it's not as if he doesn't note energies, but he doesn't exacerbate them, right. I guess, would be the difference there. But anyways, yeah, so Miss Curzon, she occupies the house with basically no malignant sort of entities hanging around her, supposedly. Maybe there were, though, and she was haunted her entire time and no one knows.
But she might have just not said anything.
That's true. Who knows, or maybe she was really blind or something. She couldn't notice it.
Deaf and blind?
Deaf and blind.
That's advantageous. It's perfect. In a haunting scenario.
But after her death, there was another fellow that came along, a Mr. Myers. And some people say in some accounts that this is when the sinister reputation started to begin for this house, but obviously it was
well previous. Before,
exactly, yeah. As we've already illustrated. So Mr. Myers, he's kind of an unknown figure during his time and after. So his contemporaries didn't really know him too well.
Yeah.
He was apparently very eccentric, and for good reason. So he occupied the house for about 20-ish years, maybe. He might have left after about 10 or 11, though. It's very vague.
It's vague, yeah.
So apparently his story goes, he was jilted at the altar.
Yep.
The poor man was set to be married. He had everything prepared for his new bride in 50 Berkeley. Everything was done to the nines, new wallpaper, fresh carpets were brought in from like the finest decor places in London. And all the best furnishings as well. So apparently he was tossed aside for another man on the day of their wedding.
Rough.
And after this terrible encounter with the opposite sex, Myers never allowed another woman or even any other person really near him. He became a hopeless recluse.
He pulled a Tesla.
He did. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was very sad. And I had a quote here from him and, well, not from him, sorry, about him. I don't know if you want to do the honor, sir, Andrew.
Yeah, the quote goes as follows. He remained there, leaving everything in exactly the same state as when he heard the news, which had ruined his life. Some of the carpets were not even unrolled and remained for years tied up just as they were when they left the warehouse.
So obviously didn't really get over. And he began just locking himself in this one room that we've mentioned, right, on the third floor, the farthest reaches of the house. He only came out at night, and he would wander around by candlelight. And many people at this time thought that 50 Berkeley was actually unoccupied, and that the ghostly light from the candle was actually just that. It was a spirit or a ghost or something. But it says here...
I mean, that is spooky. I mean, obviously people would be thinking that. You're seeing that. It looks... That would have to look like an apparition floating around the hallways.
And again, I'm going to make another really silly reference here because I grew up loving the Olsen twins, obviously. And there was this one, it was called It Takes Two. And in the very beginning, like one kid is like, you know, like she's like an orphan. She's like in like a kid's camp. And then there's like the rich, whatever, daughter. And they're actually, no, in the movie, I'm not sure if they're supposed to be siblings or not. I don't think they're supposed to be siblings, but somehow they're twins. But anyways, they exchange places, but there's this one scene where the rich kid goes to the camp and then the camp kid goes to...
That's Parent Trap.
It is, essentially. Exactly. It's very close. Same story? It's very, very close.
Oh, okay.
But essentially what happens is the kid from the camp, so I think it's Mary Kate, she goes up to the house and it's like this big sprawling mansion. And she sees, it's not night or anything, but she sees in the window the lady of the house, so this like complete biatch of a person, anyways. Right. And and she's wearing this white mask, she's doing whatever facial thing. And she literally thinks it's exactly that. Like she sees it through the window, she's like, it's a ghost! Right. And she literally runs all the way back to camp. But anyways, it just reminded me of that, because it's like, if you're a little kid and you happen to be out in the street at night and you see like a ghostly sort of candle coming from like a upper story window.
Well, and you've got no...
Your imagination's running wild.
Absolutely.
Man.
And back then, you had no other like frame of reference. Like, you know what I mean? You weren't like watching Scooby-Doo
knew.
On the weekends. You know
no
what
one
saying?
Knew so. Mr. Myers. He didn't come out during the day. You never saw him come and go out right. that front door. So therefore...
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah. So... Mr. Myers actually had a relative named Dorothy Neville. She was a great dame of the British aristocracy. And later on, so this comes in the 1900s, she actually wrote a memoir. And she describes how Thomas Myers was actually her relation.
Wow.
And that he did reside in 50 Berkeley. So until then, this resident had been mostly nameless to the majority of Londoners. And even fewer knew that it was occupied. So,
Which
again,
so
it was just
funny.
This haunting 20-year, or could be close to 20 years. I think it was more so like 11 or 12 that he occupied it. But, like, it was those 12 years. That's a long time for people to think that it was not occupied.
Totally.
And for him to similarly not really upkeep it, so it would come fall into this state of disrepair that would definitely be conducive to those types of thoughts, right?
I think the question that comes up for me with Mr. Myers is whether or not he really is just, he just fell into a spiraling state of depression,
mm-hmm.
or if that was just, or well, three options maybe, or if that was just coincidental and then he ends up in a house that's just further sucking the life out of him. There's the energy or
yeah.
presence in there is not letting him get out of that state of depression.
That's an interesting
or
way to look at it.
Or the fact that he had prepped the house before their wedding was like a curse.
Yeah.
And that's why he got dumped.
He couldn't escape it, maybe.
Anyway.
Ooh, because there was another sort of interesting side note about Myers that kind of adds to that whole, like, you know, like, is there nefarious things going on? Some say that he was really adamant of recontacting his lost love. For me, I'm thinking this is more of a vengeance type of recontacting, because apparently he was engaging in satanic worship and
yeah, so like
some sort
not,
of practices.
She's not passed away. He's trying to reach out via other means.
That's what I'm trying
means.
Exactly, right?
That's
because
like
obviously
voodoo.
She's married to another guy, so...
That sounds like witchcraft.
It does. So again, what kind of weird things did he unleash during those 12, 13... Imagine if it was 13 years.
Could
just like that post from that podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Did you know, guys, this year, Halloween is falling on Friday the 13th.
For the first time in 300 years, Halloween is on Friday the 13th. You should have seen how many people were reacting to it, being like, oh my god, I can't believe it. That's so crazy. Like,
it's going to be like Day-Day. It's going to be apocalypse.
Oh my god.
So funny. But anyways, sorry.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
A side note.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, though, because this Mr. Myers is very vague. He's very, like, creepy in himself. And just the fact that his story, right, just becoming this hopeless recluse and just being jilted, all of it is very bad juju.
Definitely bad juju. And if there was already something there, yeah, like you wrote in here, could he have awoken some sort of demonic
exactly
presence?
So, again, this is interesting. There was another thing in 1873. So the actual city of London sued Mr. Myers and the owner, this Bierstadt guy that
right.
I mentioned earlier, because they weren't paying their taxes and they weren't outkeeping the property. But apparently Myers wasn't prosecuted because of the house's reputation. And in one article, it states that both Myers and Bierstadt were summoned and neither appeared before the council. And then they just kind of basically threw it out saying, well, it's the haunted house of London, so I guess whatever.
Yeah.
It's fine. So in the meantime, they thought the house had been abandoned. So this is where Myers kind of just fades like a blip into the obscure annals of British history. And you don't really see like where he ends up. You don't really know what happens to Bierstadt.
Right.
I don't really know. But in the meantime, neighbors are still reporting unearthly moans and screams, along with the sound of furniture being dragged, with bells ringing and windows slamming.
That's unsettling.
Yeah, very unsettling. There's a lot of... That to me is like poltergeist-like activity. Unless there is a legit monstrous like entity in there doing this stuff. Like dragging furniture being dragged? What is this, like a Cthulhu type thing? Like, we're going to bring that up later.
Yeah,
but
that's coming up.
I don't know, man.
Yeah, and Myers just vanishes.
He does.
That's so bizarre.
No forwarding address. By 1972, according to most accounts, he was... What if he just disappeared into the underground of London? What if the thing just got him? The nameless horror. Who knows?
Who knows?
I don't know, man.
All right. before we continue here, we're going to say...
Doesn't that remind you of a Lovecraftian tale? Sorry, I just totally interrupted you.
No, that's
you
okay. No, that's really, totally... really, really, this, like, after we started researching this episode, I busted out the...
Oh, Lovecraft?
The, oh, what is it?
Necronomicon.
Like the anthology. Yeah, the Necronomicon anthology, which we could probably find some stuff in there to do side stories on or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, before we continue here, we are going to take our first promo break in a while.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a minute. And this one is for our friend Mike Brown over at Pleasing Terrors Podcast.
Mm-hmm.
It is an amazing show, you guys. If
perfect
you haven't checked it
Halloween
out.
Perfect for Halloween, too.
Perfect for Halloween. So he is one of the best voices out there in the biz.
He does.
Basically, an excellent storyteller. He uncovers creepy history, forgotten folklore, and all kinds of different things. Very similar to the stuff that we cover.
Mm-hmm.
So take a listen to this promo and go check out Pleasing Terrors.
Yeah, yeah.
Some stories were never supposed to be told. Stories that exist in the twilight between science and the supernatural, between history and horror. Stories that speak of terrifying things. Stories that you want to hear. Stories that you need to hear. Stories that will sink their teeth in and never let you go. My name is Mike Brown. Join me on a journey through the shadows of history. The Pleasing Terrors podcast weaves true stories of history and true crime with folklore and the paranormal. But be warned, there are no sweet dreams here, only nightmares.
And we're back.
Mm.
So yeah, make sure you guys go check out Pleasing Terrors. They are part of the Dark Myths Collective, so you can go find them on that site.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really, really great show.
Really cool show.
So we're picking up here in kind of a new era of Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
Of 50, number 50 Berkeley Square. When throughout this whole thing, I kept on writing in 1940, 1970. It's like, no. In 1872... was sort of the next stage, the next evolution of the horror of this place. There was a guy by the name of Lord George Littleton, or Lytleton, however you want to pronounce it.
I feel like it's Littleton.
Littleton.
Mm-hmm.
And he, very much like Sir Robert Warboys, was sort of dared slash on a bet, stayed a night in the building's attic. So again, I mean, brave soul based on
another
the
sort of
events.
Foolhardy kind of a person, hey?
Yeah.
And a lord, too.
Yeah, yeah, and the difference between this guy, though, and Warboys was that at the time, like I pulled this up, Lord George Littleton in 1872 wasn't a young man. He wasn't in his 20s like Warboys was. He would have been the fourth lord, the fourth baron of his descendant,
uh-huh.
And he would have been in his 50s at least.
Oh.
So anyway, he's having a few pints and obviously feeling
feeling good.
Feeling good. So very much like Warboys again, Lord Littleton was adamant that there was absolutely nothing in the house. There's no such thing as ghosts, no such thing as monsters or anything alike.
Hmm.
But just in case, he brought with him a shotgun. And it wasn't on the recommendation of the landlord this time. It was just him...
being cautious?
Yeah, I suppose being cautious, I guess. It's kind of one thing to say, no such thing as anything. And then, oh, I'll just bring a shotgun with me.
That's actually funny.
Yeah.
What the heck, man?
So once again, he goes up. Everything's quiet and normal. But later on in the night, Lord Littleton was confronted by the thing of number 50, Berkeley
Place. The nameless horror.
So, yeah. Basically, he was so frightened by this. I mean, this is kind of vague, this story. He's up in the attic. He's obviously bedded down for the night.
What is he sleeping on? Is there
okay,
a bed up there?
First of all,
there...
just because it says attic doesn't mean that it's like...
It's just the top
cobweb
floor.
Cobweb full
it's
of...
It's the top
yeah,
floor.
Like there were still bedrooms up there.
It's not like it would have been like undeveloped. Like,
no.
You know what I mean? Like
no.
How a lot of people have unfinished basements here.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
So, but it was a little vague. It's like, obviously this was later in the evening. He had been up there for a little bit, settled in, when essentially what he would later describe was a dark, misty mass of something he couldn't quite make out entered the room. He was so frightened by this that he fired his shotgun, spraying bullets all over the wall opposite him. However, the next day, there was absolutely no evidence of any such creature in the attic, nor the hallways of the home near outside the attic, nor the floor below or anything like that. He was quoted later as saying that the upper rooms of this house are supernaturally fatal to body and mind.
What?
Basically, this was the first instance where this is something beyond just a specter.
He was describing something with tentacles or long tendrils.
Yeah. A dark,
a misty
mass with tendrils and something like tentacles. Much more monster than ghost-like. That is bizarre.
That might explain, too, like, if it is this big, massive, bulking thing, perhaps that explains the thudding, right? Because you do get that in some accounts, where it's almost like coming up the stairs, where it's like thud, thud, thud. Like, it reminds me, again, of, like, a Cthulhu type of cephalopod, maybe, type of creature that is perhaps... Well, we're going to get into that in theories, but anyways, we're jumping ahead here.
A little bit, but, I mean, definitely
that is so...
That's the new evolution of this story, right? A new era for the square, because now this is something beyond a haunting.
That description is very marked to me. Just the misty, too. Misty and tendrils and a big, bulking, massive... thing like right. That is very, because up until then all we've seen really is like the aftermath of what people have seen. A lot of the times they're so petrified that either they can't describe it or they're already dead, so it's like, well, what the heck is this,
right?
Which is why it kind of gained the reputation as the nameless horror, because no one knew what it was. They couldn't name it.
Yeah.
But anyways, this is interesting because now literally less than, what is it, like 7 years later, so we jump to from 1872 to 1879, when a new family is moving into 50 Berkeley.
Yeah.
Once again, so this is a fatal sort of encounter with the nameless horror.
Fatal sort of encounter.
Fatal sort of, is that what I said?
Fatal completely.
Fatal completely. For some people.
Right.
Anyways, at this point, exactly like we've said, this is turning from a sort of haunting poltergeist story to something else, more horrific, more monstrous, perhaps, more in the realm of cryptozoology.
Possibly.
So this new family, their name was the Kentfields. It was two teenage daughters and their father.
Okay.
So no mother involved for some reason.
Okay.
And they were preparing to move into the home. It was a standard move for them. Much of the original furniture, and accoutrement of the house, decor and everything, was actually left behind. So would that have been from Curzon? Or no, it would have been from Myers.
From Myers.
Ooh, that's freaky.
Which makes sense. He wouldn't pack up his stuff and bring it with him. It's just this insane recluse that decides to disappear.
Exactly.
He's not going to call the moving company.
No, which even speaks to maybe... ill fate for him. Hey, again, like I was kind of joking when I said, oh, maybe he was sucked down to the sewers.
No, I think something bad happened to Mr. Myers.
I honestly think so too. So interestingly enough, one of Kentfield's daughters, the eldest, made note of a strange foul odor in the house, as if it had been filled with a menagerie of animals. She described it as like a musty, dank smell.
It's like a barnyard kind of a smell.
Yes. Musty, though, like that, again, alludes to water, basement, that type of thing to me. So misty and all that kind of stuff kind of plays
misty,
in.
Musty.
Misty, musty. Come on. It's like a single letter difference here.
Yeah.
Anyways. So actually, one of the maids of the house was preparing one of the rooms in the upper story. So in the attic. For a temporary stay. So she was one of the people that was supposed to prepare the household for the Kentfields on their arrival.
Mm-hmm.
She was occupying the same room that Lord Littleton had. The story goes that soon after she went upstairs, the other servants heard desperate, bone-chilling screams coming from the attic. They rushed up the stairs and burst into the room to the sight of the young maid cowering in the corner, her eyes bulging with fear, and her face completely white. She was pointing towards what was no longer there, and with what little composure she could muster, she said, "Please don't let it touch me." The maid was then actually committed to a sanatorium, and she died shortly after. I think it was less than a week after her encounter.
Now, that's disturbing.
Don't let it
touch me.
Right? And the fact that, again, she very similar to War Boy, where she's pointing to something that's not there anymore. Yeah. And the room is closed. The door's locked. Not locked, but it's closed. Shut.
There's nowhere for anything to go.
No.
That, to me,
speaks to something that's a little more interdimensional, right? Maybe this mist is something that it kind of comes up out of.
Some sort of a portal.
Yeah. But anyways, so this isn't the end of the Kentfields' terrifying encounter with this house. Their story continues, and it says here, well, according to several sources, literally half an hour after they were in the house, Captain Kentfield himself was, I guess he was upstairs in those same rooms. He actually was upstairs, and there were screams and a gunshot heard before the captain himself was discovered dead of fright.
Yeah, from the same thing. And what so, came across was that he, very much like Littleton, was like...
A skeptic?
A skeptic. He basically said like that the young woman who had just passed away in the sanatorium must have had something wrong with her. Like, had some sort of pre-existing condition or something like that. He didn't think there was anything there. He wanted to prove his family wrong. He wanted to prove his daughters wrong.
This, again, is a very simple... Like, it's a theme, right? Where it's, like, people that are more ambivalent, more less believing, end up getting the worse end of the stick, it seems.
Yes.
And it's interesting because this was actually reported to in Mayfair magazine that same year. So, 1879.
I mean,
and it details all of the tragic story elements. Right. And I couldn't actually come across, I was looking through so many different archive websites and stuff. I couldn't come across one that had more than just that, that little snippet that you see. It's just like a photo, and it's literally like a ripped old newspaper clipping from supposedly the Mayfair magazine, but doesn't even actually say it in the little shred that's left.
Right.
But it basically is recounting that story.
Yeah.
This
was from the Astonishing Legends blog, actually. This was the reason why he was going up to the room, too. It was to prove his daughters wrong, but also because apparently the room was his. It was the room that was being prepared for him as his temporary stay before the other bedrooms were ready.
Okay.
So it was being prepared for Captain Kentfield when he... You know, he still planned to spend the night in that room that same evening because it was ready for him to go and the others weren't. And he was in it for 30 minutes before they heard the screams and the same thing. Run upstairs and find him dead, face twisted with twisted in terror.
Crazy, man.
Yeah, definitely.
Don't not believe in this stuff. That's the only advice I'll give to anyone. Like, come on. Like, this is not even like the second encounter with this house, right? Like, this is like the laundry list goes on. Yeah. Man, you'd think by this point,
like, it's important to be skeptical, but at the same time you can be skeptical of those who are skeptical because if there's things that
just not be skeptical, be respectfully skeptical, maybe.
Yes. Yeah, totally,
because there's lots of stuff in this world that we do not understand, and I don't think it's best to question them and be very, like, have that type of attitude.
No, I agree. Well, in the interest of self-preservation, that's probably a good idea.
Be a little more humble, people.
And the next story here and the two gentlemen involved in it didn't really have that frank mind.
This is my favorite story.
Yeah, this one's pretty interesting, and we're just calling it The Sailors.
The Sailors.
There are three different dates for this story, depending on where you look, and we did some digging, and it was kind of hard to tell. Some state that it was only 3 years after the very early encounter with Sir Robert Warboy, so this would have placed it in the mid-1840s.
Mm-hmm.
Several other blogs place it in the evening of the Christmas Eve, 1887. And then there's a few others that reference it as the year Christmas Eve, 1943. And we'll come back. That's less important, but we'll come back to the reasons why I personally think it was 1887.
Okay.
If you believe this story to be true. So anyway, so basically it goes that two young sailors, in some accounts allegedly from Portsmouth, their names were Robert Martin and Edward Blunden. And depending on where you look as well, they were taking leave from the HMS Penelope, which I believe was a World War II vessel. So that matches up with that story. Okay. But whether or not that actually is true, they're coming from that ship or not, I don't know. Anyway, so basically, it's Christmas Eve. They've had a couple of drinks. They're celebrating. And of course, that did happen during wartime, too, if we're going with 1940s. And they needed a place to stay. So they were kind of, stumbling around downtown London, essentially, or in the area of Berkeley. And they came across the house, which is essentially, which was abandoned, right? This was one of the times when it was a little more derelict.
Exactly. It had the telltale Ferlet sign, which would be a for rent sign in North America. Right. But that's obviously very encouraging.
Which matches up with the year 1887 as an accurate date, because this would have been a time when the house stood empty.
Right.
So they had been celebrating the holiday and had a little too much to drink, so they were trying to find a place to sleep. So basically, they stumble on number 50 Berkeley, and it goes that they break into the house. So it's in some disrepair, it wasn't that difficult to break in.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom floor bedrooms were apparently really damp. They smelt musty.
Again, you get that similar.
Something like that, because clearly, if the roof was leaking, it wouldn't be the bottom floors that would be damp and musty. So that's a strange.
It is strange.
So of course, they naturally are like, hey, this isn't that comfortable. So they go up to the second floor. Apparently, Blunden, who was the slightly less intoxicated of the two, he made note of a very strange feeling in the house. But this was being completely ignored by his friend.
Mm-hmm.
And they were quite intoxicated, so they just proceeded to fall asleep. And they went to sleep in the same room together. They didn't split up different rooms.
Mm-hmm.
But not very long after this, in the late hours of the night, they awoke to a terrifying sound. They claimed that the one claimed later on that they heard a bulking mass coming up, not down, coming up the stairs, thumping as it went. Okay. So basically something akin to stomping footsteps, but not really quite sure if that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was clearly, it sounded like something doing it deliberately, like in a menacing kind of way.
I wonder what it would have been like, thump, thump. Thump.
Like, I'm picturing a more slow, menacing kind of probably shouldn't be here type of, Apparently, the sound was then followed by a terrible smell. So this is hearkening back to some of the other accounts, the Daughters of Kentfield and such. Then the door of the room swung open and a black, faceless, abject mass entered the room, blocking the doorway. Which was their only means of escape.
Entered the room. I wonder if it opened the door, if it glided through the door, if it...
The account that we have here is that the door swung open.
Okay.
So it was blocking the doorway. Okay. I love that description, though. Like, a black, faceless, abject mass.
Love that description. That's creepy, man.
Do you want to...
So this is where... Okay, we've had two different blogs. Tom Sleeman's Haunting World blog, and then also the Cryptopia blog, written by Rob Morphy, friend of Cryptopia.
Yeah.
There's discrepancies a little bit in the description. So is it a monster, or is it a ghostly entity, or is it both? I don't know. Interdimensional? But anyways, Tom Sleeman, he wrote here, quote, "The enormous shadowy figure of a man floated towards the sailors. Martin woke up and found himself unable to move. He was paralyzed with fear. Blunden tried to get to his feet, but the entity seized him by the throat with its cold, misty-looking hands and started to choke him. Martin suddenly gained enough courage to enable him to spring to his feet. He tried to confront the apparition, but was so horrified by its deformed face and body, he found himself fleeing from the house. He encountered a policeman in the square outside and told him of the vapory assailant that was throttling his friend." Okay, so that was from Tom Sleeman. And then
hands. That implies like a human.
Oh, yeah. It said here the shadowy figure of a man.
Yeah.
Didn't say bulking mass of an entity or something.
Okay.
But anyways, I'm not sure how many creative liberties they took with that.
You never know.
Cryptopia. So Morphy writes here that the sailors, quote, "came face to face with the aberrant visage of what could only be described as a hideous monstrosity. The creature undulated between the sailors and what was their only hope for escape, the open door. Then, just as the trembling Blunden began to reach for the rifle, which was still wedged in the window frame, the creature suddenly lunged forward, wrapping itself around the young sailor's throat."
So you've got hands around a throat.
What?
You've got essentially tentacles around a throat.
Okay. That's insane.
So
I don't even know. Yeah, a hideous monstrosity. Obviously, this thing is inhuman, otherworldly, like these are all things we can agree on.
Yeah.
The nuances are a little bit different though.
A little bit.
Honestly, what this first one reminds, the Tom Sleeman one reminds me of perhaps an echo from the very first, from that guy that, the uncle, remember the guy that was sort of like, he was making unwanted advances against his nieces or something
right,
like that.
Yeah, yeah.
What if this is him? What if he wasn't just like making sexual advances, but he was also very physically abusive? Like I could imagine like, he's just like choking this guy.
Well,
one
that's
thing that's
the
weird.
Apparition angle.
Exactly. Right. But then the monster, that's a little bit, that's interesting though. I never actually noticed this rifle element in the Cryptopia article where there was
right.
a rifle wedged in the window frame.
Like my explanation for that is obviously these are Navy men. They must have had weapons and maybe they propped it open to air it out.
With their gun? So there's just a gun poking out into the middle of London Street on Christmas Eve?
I guess. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of. The other thing with this and the discrepancies between these two different sort of versions.
Yeah.
The only thing that makes sense to me would be like first of all, we should give the rest of the story here.
Okay.
So, all right. So anyway, so we have one of the two sailors being essentially choked out by this monstrosity,
mm-hmm.
while the one other one managed to run, get past this monster down the stairs, outside. When the escaped sailor, the story goes, he ran out. And even though this is the middle of the night, he runs into a police officer.
Yeah. Okay.
On the beat.
Mm-hmm.
He frantically tries to explain what is going on. He basically, all he can get out is that something terrible has happened, obviously. Comes back to the scene with this police officer only to find the body of his friend had been impaled on the on the railings outside of the window. That he had either
those same railings
fallen to his
there.
Death, jumped to his death, or been thrown to his death by something in that room. So that, yeah, that's how
the three options.
That's how that story.
But that's interesting
kind of
too, because
to
again, there I'm honestly just picking up on this parallel now, which is kind of hilarious because we've been doing this research for a while. But again, the falling death, that again was the very first instance of tragedy in that house. So maybe it's replaying itself. Maybe though, you could even argue that girl who never told her story because she died. What if she wasn't trying to escape the abuses of her uncle? What if she saw that
thing.
Similar thing too?
Yeah. That's kind of what I'm leaning towards here.
Mm-hmm.
And that people would just be kind of, and what I was going to say before finishing the story here is that my explanation for the differences could be that he originally saw a monster, right? Like he thought they were attacked by this misty tendrilled mass of whatever.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Later on, that story just slightly gets tweaked a tiny bit to make a little more sense, where it's the specter of more of a human-like figure, a haunted house
mm-hmm.
type
who
situation.
Knows how much of that actually came from his mouth versus just general reporting at the time.
No way to know.
Yeah,
but that would make sense, right? Because you're going to be looked down on less to say, oh, I think I saw a ghost in the place that everyone knows is haunted,
mm-hmm.
or no, we were attacked by a
monstrosity,
by like a Cthulhu
sort of.
Octopus monster.
Yeah,
you're probably going to get locked up in the Airedale-esque asylum, right? If you, no, really, though.
Yeah,
like,
no,
you
actually.
Would be.
That's very true. Okay, wait, so I have to question you now. You said you had some reasons as to why you thought it might have been the 1870 or 1887 date.
Oh, yeah, right. So there's two main reasons. One, that from all accounts that we could come up with, the 1880s was a time when the house was most likely empty.
Oh, true. Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned that. Mm-hmm.
And this is like the most expensive place in London. So in the 1940s, I know it's wartime, but this is definitely when the people living there, the property value, this is when the Churchills of the area were in those places. Not to mention that Christmas Eve, 1943,
mm-hmm.
like we have to go back and look at, we got to go talk to our old history professor, Todd Campbell about this,
yeah.
but I know people celebrated Christmas, obviously, during the Second World War.
Nazis
would there have
Christmas?
Been naval officers just out and about walking around downtown London when there were air raids and different things like that? It sounds a little bit less likely to me that 43 would make sense.
That makes sense because during that time they had curfew.
Right.
There wasn't people on the streets.
So they would have been big time breaking the rules. Plus, for only two of them to be on their own is also kind of a weird thing.
And it's two
like
sailors
usually,
on leave?
Yeah. Well, yeah, you wouldn't have been on leave. Like, Christmas 1943.
Well, sometimes they're generous. I don't know. It's not completely implausible. But
it's not completely, but it just makes more sense to me that 1887 would have been the...
And you think there would be some references to the fact that it was wartime in Britain and that there was the potential fact of air raids. I can't remember when the bombing of London commenced and then actually finished.
Yeah, we definitely...
But I feel like it was definitely around this time.
It was in and around that time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean... It could have been boarded up in the '40s, and it could have been 43. But to me, it makes more sense that 87 they would have been in port and, you know, had some time to have some drinks and walk around. And there's a photograph supposedly of these two men, these two sailors, right? And we'll put that up online.
Yeah.
But the style of photograph, very like sepia tone or whatever. That was definitely, you know, it was very much 1880s, 1890s is what the photograph looked like to me. It didn't look like a photograph taken in 1943.
Actually, yeah, that's a really good way. Yeah, I didn't even really think about that,
to be honest. That was another aspect of that, too.
That's yeah. If we ask any, like, British naval expert, then they'll be able to tell us, I would imagine. I'm actually just researching here. I just put into my Google search engine. the bombing of London, 1943. So, exactly that. In late 1943, so around Christmas time, the Allied bombing offensives, they were actually gaining momentum against Germany. And then as a response, the Luftwaffe was preparing a bombing operation against the United Kingdom. That was Operation Steinbock, apparently.
Right.
But so I'm not sure if that had actually commenced yet or was soon to be underway. But
anyways. It's not that crucial for the story, but we like to try to dig and get the proper dates and stuff. And
we're just history geeks. We kind of are.
So, I mean, if you guys feel like doing some digging on your own, too, please do and let us know. If you think that
we can share it with the forum and all that.
Mm-hmm. Let us know if you think 1887 is the one.
We should just do a poll. See what people think.
Yeah, we could.
But, so that kind of wraps it up for a lot of the more notable stories. I was really pleased with how many we actually came up with in the end, because when you do a quick search around, you get the two quintessential ones, like the war boy one and then the sailors. But there's a lot more if you dig around. And the history is really rich. So, love this story. And thanks again to Aaron for suggesting this to us.
We have, totally.
I feel like we've used so many of his suggestions so far. Like,
he's thrown out a lot of good ones.
They're great.
And
they're
other people have as well, and they're banked. Like, they're on the list, and keep them coming.
Oh, yeah.
You guys have things you want to hear, let us know.
Yeah, and we're starting to get a lot of, like we already said, movie suggestions too. Films. And we are big into vintage films. We love that golden era of Hollywood.
Totally.
And if anyone else, like, if they have any of their favorites from that sort of era, we'd love to hear that.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyways, getting back onto topic.
We're migrating into theories and thoughts.
Thoughts and theories.
On this messed conjecture, up story.
Even though we already offered a lot of conjecture.
That's well.
Yeah. But Dubs TF people, what are we dealing with here?
Seriously, what is this?
Is this a haunted house? Is it a demonic entity? Is it a monster? Are we, like, diving into the realm of cryptozoology? What the heck, man? What do you think, Andrew?
Well...
Just put you right on the spot. I keep throwing out interdimensional, and we both said Cthulhu. I don't know.
I got to tell you, I'm leaning that way. Why don't you... Here, you should give them this this little description here from Cryptopia.
Cryptopia?
Like, okay.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, yeah. This is, again, from Rob Morphy, who writes very colorful. I love his writing. It's awesome.
Yeah,
it's
so cool.
When I'm reading his articles, I actually hear his voice in my head saying it out loud.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just awesome. But anyways, he says here, this unidentifiable monstrosity is said by some to be a vile, phantasmagorical killer from beyond the grave. Although there is some evidence to suggest that it may be a bizarre, mutant cephalopod which lurks in the filthy labyrinth of the London sewer system waiting to rise up and kill again.
So I love that. I mean, and we mentioned this already, it's this divide between kind of these two different paranormal categories here.
Mm-hmm.
Could it be somewhere in the middle? Like, where, and that's kind of like what I get when he describes it as a phantasmagorical killer and then also
A cephalopod.
Yeah. Because the mist and the...
All the elements of water.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot... Okay. Oh, yes. Okay. So, this was a point, we've already mentioned this, so it's not a huge revelation. But, yeah. So, we got that description of misty in several accounts.
Yeah.
We've gotten descriptions of a musty smell. That was from the...
Ken Fields and from the sailors.
Exactly.
Downstairs.
And... And then in modern times, which we haven't actually covered yet, this is when it converts into Madge's bookshop. It's like an antiquarian bookshop. And it was run for over 60 years. This guy, Madge's, occupied the building. Mm-hmm. Not as a tenant, though. He just ran his business.
Yeah, just the commercial space downstairs.
Which seems bizarre to me. Who was occupying the upper floors then?
I don't think anyone was.
That's weird. Time. And apparently, according to several, like, Ghost Hunt UK and other sources, there was, like, a sign, a notice saying that the top floor should never be used by anyone, including the owners, which is weird. And I did Google search it again and didn't actually see that on the door or anything.
Maybe it's on the door to the attic upstairs.
Perhaps.
Who knows?
Exactly. Yeah, up to the upper stories. But this is interesting because this brown mist is also described by this guy, Julian Wilson, who worked in the bookshop, and he actually had an office on the second floor.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. So, not the top floor or anything, but the second floor. And you do see him in a documentary. Can't remember the name of the documentary, but if you do a quick YouTube search, you'll find it. And he goes up the stairs, and then he goes and he tells this story about how he's sitting in his office, or at his desk, in the same room. He describes it as the same room, which doesn't make sense because it's on the second floor.
Yeah.
But I think he's just trying to hype up the story. But anyways, he describes how he's sitting there working at his desk, looking at his computer, and out of the corner of his eye, he saw this brownish mist appear. And it moved very quickly from one end of the floor to the other, so quite rapid how we described, which is weird, right? You think a mist would be more like
free floating or something.
Exactly. Like, a little bit more undulating.
Sure. Yeah.
In the words of Rob. But so he described that and it quickly disappeared. Nothing ever came of it. It's not like he had like a terrifying encounter where he was petrified or anything like that. And that was kind of it. He didn't really describe any sort of musty smell either.
Right. Okay, so that's a difference there.
Oh, and another really good point on the note of musty, misty, and potential water damage and things that could explain that smell. Doesn't make much sense to open up a bookshop if you have water issues, which to me speaks to another source for those sound or smells and that mistiness.
Yeah, it clearly wasn't from the plumbing,
no.
So to speak. But there's definitely aspects of this that would make people who are skeptical think things like that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so I have another, like, we're leaning on you, Rob Morphy, like, because that was a great article.
It really was.
Especially when it comes to, like, the cryptozoological angle, obviously, right?
Yeah.
So this was another sort of me paraphrasing from Rob's article on Cryptopia, which you guys should go check out. But, like, we're dealing with an amorphous being, formless and slimy. So
what?
Formless, that's...
Slimy? Was there remnants left behind?
So here's the thing. So apparently, I guess another sort of extended version of the sailor's story would be that there was a gruesome sloppy, there's gruesome sloppy noises that come along with the encounters with this thing.
Oh dear.
When it moves, when it was coming up and down stairs, there's thuds, but also they claim that there's these noises, these, like, I can just picture it, right? It's like... sloppy, just disgusting
sounds.
It's
like a wet, like, suckering kind of weird sound, yeah.
While others obviously describe it, like we said, like a shapeless spectral form or a collection of shadows, right? That apparently, in some accounts, according to Rob's article, attacks its victims with clawed feet and sharp razor-like bird talons.
What?
So those are strange. Like, that's,
that reminds me of the beak of an octopus.
Yes.
That can be quite
exactly.
sharp.
That's exactly what I'm leaning towards here. So... they're sort of conflicting, right? Like, it's conflicting, but all these things and the encounter with the sailors have led sort of researchers to pretend to think that maybe we're dealing with some sort of small, deformed, mutant freshwater octopi.
Okay.
Or cephalopod, like we've mentioned, right?
That's coming up from the
sewers?
That
would leave a viscous trail in its wake as it moves about the house. But now, we didn't have trace evidence from the Littleton, from the Kentfield, from the maid that died shortly after. There was no slime trail. So,
no.
That is like, excuse me, that's like coming back around to the interdimensional aspect of this monster. Very much like a Cthulhu to me. Because this doesn't get us any closer to what this thing is looking
it,
at
is it ghost
things.
Goo? You know what I mean? Have you ever heard that? The ghost slime?
Oh, yeah.
That's a thing people report, but I don't know if that actually hangs around or if it disappears or...
Do you think that there could be some type of semi-aquatic cephalopod lurking beneath the sewers of London, that this thing is potentially a mutant?
I'm not going to say no because... all the evidence seems to point
all the evidence
towards the possibility of something like that. And I'm not going to sit here and say it's not, because
so the creepiest thing about that thought is that that would mean that such a creature would have to have its nest or something alike in the depths of number 50 Berkeley Square, right? So it's some sort of unknown marine ancient creature that's managed to migrate from the River Thames into London's sewer system.
That's, it's far-fetched. It's not the most far-fetched thing I think we've ever covered on this show, so I like that.
I mean,
that,
that's
though.
The cryptozoological realm of this.
Yeah, because
right, and that would explain why these things aren't happening anymore. Like, people feel weird things, they see things, and there's still sort of, like, paranormal stuff people might claim later on.
Oh, they do, yeah.
Nobody's been attacked by this creature
which
since.
Which almost, like, I really, really, really love that thought and that sort of idea, but at the same time, is it, if you're thinking in sort of, like, the Occam's razor or whatever, like, what is the simplest, I feel like a lot of that colorful language could have been just, like, added in over the years.
It could have been, for
and
sure.
the descriptions, because the whole, like, razor claw talon things, that's crazy, too.
But that could be, like, I mean, like you said, that's very much like the beak of an octopi, though, like an octopus.
Mm-hmm.
Super sharp, and they're, you know, the idea would be that it would be feeding off rats and different things in the sewer system, right? That it would have evolved to be sort of semi-aquatic. And I stumbled across a very interesting article claiming that in 2008, this is from the Daily Mail, they reported that sewer workers nearby that were basically working at a water treatment plant claimed that they were being stalked by an unknown creature that they could only describe as being the total abject. It was human-like, but not at all at the same time, living in the sewers. The sewers worker believed in this thing. So according to the workers, the figure would follow them around and make noise reminiscent of laughter or some type of squealing that was very menacing. And it persisted for so long that eventually paranormal investigators would go and try to look into this.
Mm-hmm.
And after spending some time down in the sewers and doing their testing, they turned up no trace evidence, but they felt the presence of things living amongst them down there and apparently also came across completely devoured carcasses of rats. And apparently, too, they would even hear, they heard, like, voices coming from behind walls where there couldn't possibly be any city workers.
That's weird.
Now, that is obviously a different angle altogether. That's, like, a population of humanoids living in the sewer. But
I feel like we're migrating significantly here. Like, there are multiple things going on at this house, because in the early years, you do get more of a haunting-esque type of thing going on where people see spectral entities, like, falling to their deaths repeatedly over a series of nights. And then it evolves into something different. And again, like I said, like, how much of this comes from the lore created through fiction, through the spread of rumors on the streets, in publications,
that.
All that kind of thing?
When you wrote down here, I mean, there's some famous authors.
There
with
is.
Links to 50 Berkeley.
Exactly. Charles Dickens had a big interest in this particular house, and even, like, he had a character in one of his stories called Great Expectations, I believe, and it was a Miss Havisham. I might have that wrong, but I think it was Havisham, and she essentially is Mr. Myers. Like, she's the female version of him, where she essentially gets jilted, and he said that he had inspiration in real life from her. But he never divulged what that was, so perhaps it actually was Mr. Myers, even though some people will allude to this one woman in Australia that was apparently very similar, who left her, like, wedding cake to rot and everything after plans didn't work out. And then there was another one in New York, apparently, or somewhere in the U.S. that was very similar and had left an entire feast left to just, like, rot. But anyways, I honestly feel like Mr. Myers is a better better inspiration than those two.
Yeah, I'd say so, too.
And then you also get another author, I can't remember his name now, but apparently he used 50 Berkeley as the setting for one of his stories, and afterwards, what's his name? Oh my gosh, I'm totally blanking. The Necronomicon author.
Lovecraft.
Lovecraft. He actually said that it was the best short story written about a haunted house ever.
Really? That's saying something.
So again, you do get like, literally Lovecraft is involved. He's tangled in here.
Yeah.
So, like, what if over the years could have divulged devolved into something involving his characters, right? Because you do get this Cthulhu-like monstrosity.
Unless the...
So my question is, what is coming first? The accounts or the fiction that sort of bleeds into and creates this folklore, all these rumors and the legend, and ultimately an urban legend? I don't know.
And I think, well, that would definitely... See, coming back to the sailor's story, when that story happened actually really matters then, when you bring in Lovecraft being involved. Because if it was in the 1880s, that would make way more sense, because Lovecraft became most famous in the 20s.
Okay.
I believe.
So, it was definitely early 20th century.
Yeah, so he would have been a young kid at the time. That story would have come out, right? Mm-hmm. Like, maybe that's where Cthulhu came from.
Perhaps, actually, that's like interesting
these accounts,
too.
Right?
Yeah.
Because that kind of makes sense to me. It's very similar.
It is.
Monster.
It is.
What? Okay. I mean, I guess if we can kind of like, if we're coming down to the wire here, we're going to wrap this up.
We are coming down to the wire.
I mean, if you had to kind of lean towards one thing, what is it? What are you thinking is the explanation for the events at this house?
Like, in some of the sources we read, I feel like it might even be the freaking building itself. Like, it's just, like, emanating this weird spectral, like, energy that's just very... that can manifest in various ways and almost maybe perhaps has its own consciousness about it, too, where it will leave some people alone. It will leave the Miss Curzons of the world alone and the Madges who... respect them. It was interesting, actually, this the bookshop owner, Mr. Madges, I don't know if I'm saying that right, sorry if I'm not.
Mags or something, or I don't know.
Mags, I don't know. But he said that he did feel a presence. He just respected it, and he considered it in much the same way as a lot of the first edition books that he, like, reads, like, where he's, like, he made the analogy, like, oh, yeah, I'm reading Captain Cook's memoirs, and I feel like I know him, and I feel like I know the spirits of this place in a very similar way, where they're kind of just like there. They're
That's
just present.
The right approach to have, I suppose.
But apparently, this guy, he didn't last very long. The bookshop, well, he lasts very long. He stayed there for about 60 years. The bookshop is now closed.
Yeah.
In 2015, it closed down. And apparently, the new owners do report objects being thrown around, a strange brown mist floating on the premises, and it's been closed to investigation, though. Like, it's not really open to the public at all.
Yeah.
And it's very frustrating for people like Ghost Hunt UK.
Right. Yeah, no
They're
kidding,
mad
right.
about it. But I don't know. I'm thinking more leaning towards... I don't know, Andrew. Why do you make me do this?
I know. There was one interesting story that, for the skeptics out there, they would definitely latch onto this. And Rob mentions it in his article, and it's all over the internet as well, that there was a paranormal investigator in the 1920s named Harry Price, who allegedly dug up some information from old publications, basically stating that in 1790 or thereabouts, there was a counterfeiting operation going on at the 50 Berkeley, which literally would have been in the very first years of it being built.
Yeah.
But that the owners or the people, you know, running it concocted stories about ghosts and monsters to keep people away.
Oh.
Very much like a Scooby-Doo-esque kind of a scenario. I don't know how accurate that is, just because this guy dug it up in a newspaper. It doesn't mean anything, right? Lots of yellow journalism in the late 1800s and things like that. So it could just be an article about whatever.
Yeah.
But I thought that was kind of funny and kind of interesting.
That is.
And because, of course, that's tied to the haunted ghost aspect, whether it's fake or
right.
not. I think that ultimately, I almost feel like, as much as I want to lean cryptozoological or interdimensional with, like, a monster that is more of a physical entity, which I basically do in every episode, I think this is really a haunted house. I think that there is a haunting going on here, and that the experiences people have that are very different, whether it be a spectral human-like creature, human-like person, you know, strangling you with icy hands, or if it is a tentacled mass that can't really be described, I think these are just people's, this is just the context for them. This is their nightmares. You're seeing what you're seeing in the moment when this energy is like, and it doesn't mean that, Joe Blow is afraid of octopi. So therefore that's what he sees in the doorway. It doesn't have to make sense. It's just different for everyone.
That's cool.
But I feel like...
Or what if it's a shapeshifter? And it's just like, oh, this is the shape I'm in right now. Could so be. That's what you're getting.
I mean, obviously, to go cryptozoological, though, the picture of the basement, like the sewer system beneath the house,
yeah,
it looks like huge. Like, you could fit a speedboat in there.
Oh, yeah.
And that's sort of creepy. So, like, if you want to go that route, like, things could be swimming around in the sewers. That's for sure. There was a story way back in the day about, like, black swine in the sewers of London. Like, literally, ooh, like, full-size hogs, oh, like, wow, eating stuff and living down there.
Interesting.
Obviously, people know about the alligators in New York sewers and true, all those stories and things like that. That's an angle,
it's
too.
It's freaky. Like, yeah, that photo that I think I'm remembering, the one that you're referencing,
creepy,
and it is really creepy. It's like this huge open like catacomb like
yeah
thing.
Hop
and like
in your kayak,
I'm wondering,
and go for a cruise.
I know. I'm wondering too, like, how much access each building would have had to that area.
Don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, I wonder, because the construction would have been a lot different than modern construction.
Definitely,
that probably wouldn't have allowed that.
This overall, though, one of my favorites that we've covered so far, because it was just rabbit hole after rabbit hole, and I wanted that. Like, it was fun.
It really was fun.
And this episode could keep going. Like, there's more, but...
There is. There's...
You know what? We've covered the juicy stuff.
Yeah.
That's my take on it.
Yeah.
We want to know what you guys think. What is going on? What was going on at number 50, Berkeley? Like, do you think it's a monster? Do you think it's an apparition? Do you think that maybe it was built over top of grounds with some ancient stuff going on?
And who is going to have the next tale to tell
yeah
about 50 Berkeley?
Exactly.
And the nameless horror.
Yes. Two more things before we exit here, folks. Don't forget the pumpkin carving contest.
Please don't. Yeah.
And number two, next week we have the second installment of our Film Fridays.
Oh, yeah.
And we will be discussing The Ritual.
The Ritual. So now, make sure you put yeah on your watching hats
exactly
and go get on Netflix if it's on there or
yeah
whatever.
So hopefully
service
you guys all have access to it. That's the one we're covering. It's an awesome movie, so go check that out.
Watch it
in the dark.
Third thing, we are also releasing our October... I'm sorry, it's a little bit late.
A little late.
Our October Patreon bonus minisode.
Yes.
And it's freaky.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a spooky one. So
it's
go
really...
check us out on patreon.com/intotheportal and see what we have to offer.
Mm-hmm.
So until next time, you guys, or I guess I should say too, like, shoot out your ideas to us, as
mm-hmm
always, intotheportalmailbox@gmail.com.
Yep.
Or DM us on any social media platform.
Mm-hmm.
You guys know where to find us.
Yep.
And until next time.
Mm-hmm.
To modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.